Why? Why are you doing this? Greg, there's something I want to explain to you, something important, but I can't. You'll figure it out in time. But I want to know now. Why can't you tell me now? You wouldn't understand. This, of course, just frustrated the stew out of me. It had been a hard year, my first year in kindergarten. My parents were struggling with what would eventually end up as divorce. And now my babysitter was telling me that she was leaving to go to college, and she wouldn't explain why she had to go halfway across the country instead of staying at one of the dozens of colleges that were very close to home. Things will change for you someday, and maybe then it will make sense. But I don't want things to change. Someday you may look forward to change. Not me, I don't want to change. You will. Well, what's wrong with me the way that I am? Why do I need to change? Well, nothing is wrong with you, but do you want to be 5 years old forever? This one stumped me, and I was silent. Someday it'll make sense to you. No, it won't, I protested. Well, then I'll just have to come back and explain it to you, she said. But she never did. There is a theory that all ministers have two things in common. First, we all had sadistic babysitters. And it is said that we were all placed in the care of people who kept us perpetually frustrated with unresolved questions. And that prompted us to spend our lives searching for people we could care for so that we could systematically return the favor and frustrate them with the same kind of unresolved questions. This, as far as the UUA knows, is true. So it is here that I would like to mention to you that there is something that I want to explain, something important I think you need to know. But I can't, at least not quite yet. Bellum, you'll figure it out in time, maybe even by the end of this sermon. The second thing that all ministers have in common is that we all have a love-hate relationship with change. We want people to know that they are good just the way they are, but we also want them to change. There is a saying that the only thing that ever likes change is a wet baby. I said this to a friend of mine who is a change consultant, a spiritual director in people's lives, helping them discover their own power and manifest their own dreams, and he responded that he's actually come across a number of people who've gotten quite accustomed to living in dirty diapers. Because change, even change for the better, is uncomfortable. It's disorienting. It requires vision. It demands discipline. And no one likes it. And yet it is also inevitable. Like the Greek philosopher Heraclitus once said, "The only thing permanent is change." He learned that from Isaac Asimov. People, you understand, people who anticipate change tend to be the people who become the authors of our future. As Winston Churchill once said, "I know history will be kind to me because I intend to write it." Biologically, we are all hardwired to notice change. When some stimulus in our environment pops up, it becomes a neural red flag that sends a potential signal of danger to our limbic system, trying to assess the potential threat to our survival. But constantly monitoring for change in our environment is anxiety-producing, and it's exhausting. Studies of human brainwaves show that relaxation only comes with situations where there is a certain level of predictability, where we are allowed to drop our guard because our environment appears stable. So our natural tendency is to set up predictable patterns in our lives. Avoid change unless you can help it. And this is corroborated by the way that we often talk to one another. People ask how you're coping with change. We brace ourselves for change. As a matter of fact, the only time that we ever tend to recommend change is when we notice that someone around us looks so terrible, we say, oh, well, a change will do you good. Indeed, we are often praised for our ability to resist change. When I served the congregation in Atlanta, I learned the prominent Southern compliment exchanged by two old friends when they say, well, look at you, you haven't changed a bit. Well, neither of you, bless your heart. It's lucky that we don't detect most of the change right around us. Otherwise, we'd be nervous wrecks. For instance, how safe do you think we would feel if we happened to notice that the Earth is spinning at a surface level of just over 1,000 miles per hour and that we are hurtling through space around the sun at 67,000 miles per hour? And then think how we'd feel if we realized that every single minute, every 60 seconds, we are losing 30 to 40,000 skin cells. That every 3 days, our entire outer layer of our body is completely replaced. And that every time we dust, since skin cells are the major component of household dust, we are just wiping ourselves up and throwing ourselves away. Sometimes it's better that we aren't aware of all the change around us. But sometimes it isn't. Remember the quote I offered a couple weeks ago by W. Edwards Deming. Deming, you might know, was the American statistician who revolutionized the modern manufacturing system in the 1950s when he worked for Ford Motor Company. And he decided to leave America and go to Japan, which was one of the reasons that Japan's auto industry thrived and emerged as one of the world leaders during the 70s, 80s, and 90s. He fit his thoughts about change into two sentences. He said, it's not necessary to change. Survival is not mandatory. Many people who hear that quote are left hemming and hawing, which is a very common reaction to change. Some years back, a book came out about change that became a number one bestseller. You might have read it yourself, called Who Moved My Cheese? Anybody read that? It's about a short fable about two mice, Sniff and Scurry, and two little people, Hem and Haw, who are trapped in a maze looking for cheese. And the mice use instinct and adaptability and resilience to search for the cheese, and the little people used more powerful brains and belief systems and emotion and logic and rationale in their search. And as the fable begins, all four start out in the maze until, after only a short time, they come across the motherlode of cheese, and they are ecstatic. The place becomes known as Cheese Station C. They eat their fill, and then they go home. And when they go back the next day, they are excited to see that the cheese is still there, even more of it. Again, they eat and they get full. They go home. Nothing changes that day or the next or the next. And pretty soon, expectations develop and habits form. A groove gets worn in the path from their homes to Cheese Station C. It becomes their path. They don't get as excited each subsequent morning to find Cheese Station C and all the cheese. They've come to expect that. In fact, they tend, after a while, to get up a little later each day. They get to the cheese, and then they take off their shoes. They eat their fill. They loosen their belts. They eat some more. They fall asleep. They waddle home and do it all again the next day. Their lives become more predictable, a little bit more comfortable. And then one day, everything changes for the four of them. They arrive one morning at Cheese Station C, just like any other day, but the cheese is gone. The mice, Sniff and Scurry, notice this. They look at one another, they size up the situation, and immediately they go back out into the maze and look for more cheese. But the book is not about the mice. It's about us. It's about hem and haw and how they use their sophisticated brains to deal with cheese. Hem and haw stand before the emptiness of their beloved cheese station C in disbelief. No cheese? They cry. This is impossible. There's always been cheese. And then they start screaming, "Who moved my cheese?" Hem and haw decided that it was their cheese. They talked about how unfair the situation was and how much they deserved the cheese on account of having had to work so hard to find it in the first place. They talked about wanting compensation for the cheese that had been taken from them. Retribution. Wasn't there somebody that they could sue? And after a while, Haw began to wonder if maybe they shouldn't accept the fact that there was no more cheese and just go back out into the maze. And Hem said that that was unthinkable. Why should he have to change? After all, he wasn't the one who made the cheese go away. There is a nickname for this kind of attitude, and I learned it when I was a chaplain at Toronto General Hospital. My supervisor, Ken Jackson, on our first day of all the new chaplains, he introduced us to the idea that we would all inevitably, in our rounds, encounter a certain kind of patient. Patients who came in with a malady that was rarely described in their chart and often undiagnosed completely, but very debilitating. They showed symptoms of anger and outrage. They believed it was completely unfair that they were sick, that their good health had been taken from them. Cancer and heart attacks, after all, they reasoned, were things that were supposed to happen to other people, bad people. Ken gave this disease a name. He called it GIDE, G-I-D-E, which is an acronym which stands for Grandiose Infantile Demands of Entitlement. I found that nickname very amusing, but of course it's funny because it's true. Demands of entitlement are what make it so hard to change. When we think about how changes come so infrequently or so slowly in systems of racism or sexism or classism or ableism or homophobia, one of the reasons is entitlement. People who feel entitled, the people in control, too often feel justified, even morally empowered, to keep a system in place that supports their entitlement. Even when the issue of entitlement isn't at work, there is still another major hurdle before we adapt or even welcome change. We have to be willing to assume the discomfort and uncertainty that comes with returning to the unpredictable or going back out into the maze. But that's hard. When Haw raised the issue of going back out into the maze, Hem plainly told him that he'd rather keep returning to Cheese Station C. More cheese was bound to show up. Those who read the book know that Haw sticks around for a while, but eventually he gets fed up waiting for yesterday's cheese to show up. And each time he tries to leave and start looking for tomorrow's cheese, he is ridiculed by Hem. "We're too old for this," Hem says. "Do you want to feel like a fool running around in the maze? Wait here with me until they put the cheese back. You'll just get lost in the maze." Sometimes we can find ourselves in a system where change is so feared it is heavily discouraged, sometimes even punished. Such a system is described in a well-known behavioral experiment. 5 apes were placed in a cage, and in the center of the cage were a set of stairs that led up to a banana that was hanging down from the ceiling by a string. Before long, one of the 5 apes noticed the banana and went over to the stairs, climbed the stairs, and reached up to get the banana. But as soon as he put one foot on the stairs, all the apes in the cage were sprayed with cold water. Right? After a while, another ape would make an attempt, and the same result. All the apes were sprayed with cold water until all of them got used to that. As soon as that reality became familiar, scientists turned it off. And even though they turned it off, they found that when another ape tried to climb the stairs, all the other apes would prevent it from doing so, even though no water sprayed them. They next removed one of the apes from the cage and replaced it with a new one. And seeing the banana, the new ape tried to climb the stairs to get the banana, but to his horror, all of the other apes ran over and attacked him. Another attempt and another attack, and he finally discovers that if he tries to climb the stairs, he will get beaten up. Next, they remove another of the original five apes and replaced it with a new one. The newcomer notices the banana, goes to the stairs, and is also attacked by all the apes. The previous newcomer takes part in the punishment with enthusiasm. Again, one of the original apes is replaced with a new one. The new one makes it to the stairs and is attacked as well. Two of the four apes that beat him up had no idea why they were not permitted to climb the stairs or even why they were participating in beating up the newest ape. After replacing the fourth and fifth of the original apes, all the apes that had ever been sprayed with cold water have been replaced. Nevertheless, no ape is ever again allowed to approach the stairs. And after a while, none of them even try, even though none of them understand the phenomena of being sprayed with cold water. Why not? Because that's the way that it's always been done here. Who moved your cheese? Why am I talking about this at all? There are five reasons. The first one is obvious. This suitcase here is not just a gimmick. It has a real purpose, and it is to remind us constantly that we are all traveling in the midst of change. You did not ask for this change. Just as James didn't ask for the change in his life, you didn't ask to have Reverend Nancy leave. Sometimes change is something that we initiate, and sometimes it is thrust upon us. But there is always a choice of how we deal with it. Do we become authors and designers and engineers of the change in our midst, or do we passively just react to the change of the world around us? Destiny is written by those who choose to be authors. And you look at all you've been doing to write your own future here in this community. You have this nutty PowerPoint thing. You've changed some of the ways that we participate in worship, including like having Lee here speaking this morning and Kim doing a testimony. You're in the midst of creating a comprehensive safety policy. You're transitioning into new leadership in voice and in the food pantry. You're helping to create a covenant of loving relationship. You're changing the governance structure of the congregation to allow for better communication and coordination. And you're in the midst of writing a 2-year long-range plan. That's a lot of change. And it's positive, proactive change that's helping you become the authors of your destiny. Second reason I mention it is look around you. Is there anyone in the congregation that wasn't here 2 years ago? Raise your hand. Keep your hands up. Anyone here in the congregation recently take on a new leadership position? Keep your hands up. Anyone feel passionate about this church and the direction that it may take in the next 2 years? Keep your hands up. Anyone feel really concerned about the challenges facing Prince William County and have been waiting for a long time for someone or some place to rise up and be a proactive stance of change in the community? Raise your hands. You want to know who moved your cheese? All the people who raise their hands move your cheese. They move your cheese all the time. Does anybody know the 7 last words of a dying church? We've never done it that way before. The third reason that I'm talking about change is because we're in a church. And I'm not saying that to make any distinction between a church and a synagogue, because in this one respect, there is no difference. So many people today have the mistaken notion that being part of a church or a synagogue is about finding sanctuary from the world. It's about creating security, that it stands for something that is unmovable in a sea of change, that it's about finding the one true answer and practicing the one true way, and that as long as we behave and abide, God will love us and all will be well in the heavens. That is not a church or a synagogue. That's organized denial. And the worst part about it is that it denies the very heart of what religious communities stand for, which is transformation. We come into religious community not for comfort, but to be moved to our best selves. We come to be lifted out of the mental and spiritual and emotional ruts that eventually lead to uninspired lives. And we come, as the saying goes, to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable, always looking for a way to move from what we have been to what we can be. That's what a church or a synagogue is all about. Fourth, I talk about change because of who we are as Unitarian Universalists. There is very little about our movement that has remained constant over our long and illustrious history. Our view of God has changed and is still changing. Our view of Jesus, of heaven, of hell, of humanity, of what we are called in the world to lead good and responsible lives, all of that has changed. When the Reverend Louis B. Fisher, the Dean of the Universalist Seminary of St. Lawrence University, was asked years ago where our great movement stands on the issues of the day, he said, "We don't stand, we move." UU historian Barry Whittemore describes Unitarian Universalism as part of a 2,000-year-old Jewish reform movement. "The only difference," he says, "between us and other religions is that we have never stopped reforming. The need for religious reformation wasn't over when the Jews rebuilt the temple, and it wasn't over when Jesus was born, or when he was crucified, or when Martin Luther tacked his theses on the door of Wittenberg, or when Martin Luther King helped to change civil rights. And it won't be over when we finally make it possible for gays and lesbians to legally marry the person of their own choice in the state of Virginia. The Reformation won't be over until all people are free. And amidst the struggle, when we stand with brothers and sisters who are black and white and gay and straight and young and old and Christian and Jewish and Muslim and atheist, when we are asked if we have finally learned to choose love instead of fear when resolving our conflicts, we will look out in the world and cry in one single voice, Bellum. Not quite yet. But until such a day arrives, we are reformers and change agents still. And finally, we need to embrace change because of the questions that we each walk into this place with. Have I become the person that I've always wanted to be? Have I found all the truth that there is to find? Do I have enough love? Do I have enough friends? Enough people I can count on the hard times? We come here to this church to think about those questions, and inevitably, invariably, our answer is the same. Bellum, not quite yet. This mixed up, crazy, wonderful world is not yet done changing, and neither are we. So there is something that I need to tell you, something that I hope you'll understand, and perhaps it is what my babysitter was trying to tell me those years ago. And it is the wisdom captured in the title of a popular play. I love you. You're perfect. Now change. We are about the work of finding tomorrow's cheese. Because as time marches on, none of us wants to be 5 years old forever. My greatest prayer for you and this church is that your vision of what happens next in Prince William County in the 21st century is that no one will ever walk into this place after being gone for a week or a month or a year or 10 years and have that tired old refrain handed to them, "Oh, you haven't changed a bit." Because what a slap in the face that is for religious people like us finding our way in the world to the glory of life.